Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, a special health report on what we can learn for safety and quality in healthcare from the airline industry. And we're going to use as our example QF32. Some of you might have heard the story before. Some of you might have read the book by Richard de Crespigny, the senior pilot, the senior captain on board QF32. It was a flight that probably should have crashed, but it didn't crash for lots of different reasons. A lot of it to do with teamwork and systems and making things go right. Richard de Crespigny's got very interested over the years in the applicability of what he's learned to healthcare. And he's worked in partnership with Paul Barish, who's an anaesthetist and researcher on safety and quality in healthcare at Wayne State University in Michigan. Well, welcome to you both. Richard, some people will have heard your story. Many people have read your book, but they will never tire of hearing the story. So just remind us the story of QF32.
Well, it's 8 years ago now, the 4th November 2010, and we were taking off in an A380, Airbus A380, the biggest, most complex aircraft in the sky. And 4 minutes after takeoff, engine number two exploded. But it exploded in a way a Rolls-Royce engine has never exploded before. Instead of the damage being contained, the damage exited the engine and then caused about 650 wires to be broken. About 21 out of 22 systems were affected. And it put us into a crisis that had not been analysed or planned for by the certifiers of aircraft. The aircraft had damage so extensive that complex systems took out other complex systems. And what brought us down was combined leadership, teamwork, knowledge and experience of all the crews involved.
So let's double back. How many people were on board?
469.
469. So a lot of lives to be responsible for. So let's start with the day, because what I remember of your story is your attitude towards teamwork, because one of the features of being a pilot in a modern airline, one is no matter how senior you are, you're always getting monitored and tested.
That's right. Seven times a year.
And you're tested by a pilot, one of your peers.
Correct.
And it's always a new team.
It's like Groundhog Day. Every day we start a new team and you learn from days that don't go so well. So you learn to develop your leadership skills and how to build and develop teams that work well together.
And you're also, maybe a little bit unusual, is that you actually went to see the A380 being built before you started being a pilot.
I was writing a technical book to replace a book called Handling the Big Jets, which is a Bible for pilots wanting to go to the airline. So I was going to rewrite that. So I was 30% complete. I had visited Airbus and Boeing, spoken to the test pilots. I was in the Rolls-Royce factory where they built the engines, the Trent engines, 2 weeks before the engine exploded. I had gone into all this detail to understand how I could write this book about handling the big jets.
And you'd seen the A380 being built, if I remember right.
Correct.
And so you had some insight into how things worked.
Well, I spoke to all the design engineers, the aerodynamicists who designed the aircraft. I understood the aerodynamics. I understood the mechanics, the kinematics of the flight control systems.
So the day comes, you're in Singapore International Airport, the team is coming together. What's your approach to a new team? Because I think in the last interview that I did with you, you talk about in regular teams, familiarity breeds contempt.
Absolutely. It builds normalized deviances. The more you know someone, the less you're about to criticize them, particularly if they're a friend. You would be reticent to say, look, I think you're doing the wrong thing. So you tend to put up with their idiosyncrasies, you normalize the deviances. And before long, you've really gone off the rails of, in our case, of how to fly an aircraft the way it was designed to be flown. So the safest flight in my airline is where we've never flown with any other pilot before. And I would say, look, I don't know you, Paul. I respect you. You've passed all your tests. So you are absolutely qualified to sit in that seat and I won't question you. But all I need you to do is to do what you're trained to do. I'll do what I'm trained to do. Let's keep to our areas of responsibility and everything will go just fine.
Paul, before we continue with the QF32 story, I mean, this whole thing about the surgical checklist and people talking, and many surgeons don't do the surgical checklist, but it's kind of similar, isn't it?
It is similar. What began many years ago is a deep realization that healthcare was more improvisational. And so as an effort to try to bring more structure, Atul Gawande and others brought out a checklist mimicked and modeled after aviation, in which a group of surgical team members, nurses, anesthesiologists, anesthetists, and surgeons would come together and all agree in a brief checklist, we're doing this patient, this procedure, this day. And this has showed around the world a reduction in errors and a reduction in harm.
So let's go back to the situation at Singapore Airport, because it wasn't just you and a co-pilot.
There were three pilots in the team, myself, the co-pilot, and a second officer. And then there were two captains who would check me. Well, there was a captain learning to be a check captain. So there was a check captain training a check captain to check me. But in the way out in the bus, I said, we have to understand our responsibility. We are responsible to
the
passengers.
So you actually say this on the bus?
I say this. I said this in front of them. It might be confronting, but I said this aggressively. I said, we are responsible to the safety of the passengers. This route check is not important. Don't worry about it. That's my problem. Your responsibility is to keep this operation safe. You must highlight any mistake that I make. Don't worry about my route check and ignore the other two captains. They will stay silent. We're a team of three and our priority is to the passengers to get them to the destination safely.
I wonder what's sitting behind that conversation is what's called non-technical skills. In other words, you assume that if the pilot's good enough to sit beside you, they've got the technical skills to fly the plane. What you're making sure of is that their non-technical skills, their communication, is going to be up to the task of keeping things safe.
I have to know any feedback to the captain saying, Captain, I think you're doing it the wrong way. You haven't done something, which is like someone saying to a doctor, you haven't washed your hands. If someone has gone to the effort to say that to me, I don't see that as a personal affront. They did it because they are worried about safety and I must listen to them.
Of course, and that's so a conversation, Paul, that almost never happens in medicine.
Exactly.
So the assumption is the people around you, the anaesthetist, the assistant surgeon, the surgeon, if you're talking about surgery, but there's plenty of other situations where the assumption is that you've passed your exams, you know what to do. And when problems happen, it's because this conversation hasn't happened.
Well, the concept that we're a team in healthcare, I think, is a fallacy. We're a group of talented people working together, and that's very different than a structured team that trains as a team. We don't train as a team in medicine. We train separately. We work together in the same space, but we have very little interdependencies. And then finally, when things go wrong, we go to our own corners, anesthetists separately, nurses separate, surgeons separate. We rarely come together. And so the learnings don't happen as quickly, and therefore we continue to have the same failings.
Okay, Richard, you get off the bus, you get into the cockpit, and you take off, and then this explosion happens. Just talk us through what happens next.
So 4 minutes after takeoff, the engine explodes. It takes out 650 wires, half the networks, damages 21 out of 22 systems on the aircraft.
Did you actually know that? That's what you know now.
No, we didn't.
So tell me what you saw. You're sitting there in the captain's seat.
Alarm bells are ringing continually because when alarm goes off, you must silence it by pressing a cancel button. That stops the light and it cancels the alert. But we had 120 checklists that we did in the air. And every time at least 120 alarm bells goes off and we cancel it and then another one comes up. So Matt, the first officer, and I were pressing this cancel button, but the distraction of noise in the cockpit with bing, 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 while everyone's trying to work is extreme. And so that adds to the startle effect and the confusion. We are trained in simulators to be given the very difficult things, disruptive, startle effect type creation distractions, and we have to have procedures to work through that. There's two parts. One is just what we call aviate, fly the airplane, stay alive. Then number two is navigate and then communicate, tell people what to do. For the first 20 seconds, no one said a word. I was just stabilizing the aircraft, reading up what I had with the heading, the altitude, the mountains and the safety heights. And I said, we are safe. And then I said to Matt, ECAM actions, which means start the checklist.
And is it just you and the co-pilot at this point, or are the check captains starting to do?
They were taking an interest.
One
of the check captains stood up, and he thought we're only flying on one engine. Automation relies on sensors coming in, but a lot of our sensors were broken, so we were making decisions without full information coming in. Everything's focused on what do you have at the time, and how do you navigate ahead.
Now, ping, 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 ping is a familiar sound in healthcare.
It is. We have a term for this. We call this alarm fatigue. We have way too many alarms that go off because the devices don't interop very well. So the interoperability between information systems and between technical input systems means that you as a clinician have to decide what to turn off. And so we get at least 120, for example, different alarm systems in the operating theater. Many of them go off without, they don't quite know why. So you have to turn them off. And if you turn them off, sometimes that could be detrimental. It's unclear. And so again, this issue between smart and clumsy technology is a big challenge.
But there's a whole industry now in healthcare simulation.
For about 20 years in anesthesia, we have developed, based on aviation, something called crew resource management, in which you put people into a simulated crisis and then you turn up the heat. Things fail, electricity goes down, the wrong gas, the wrong that. And then you try to help people understand what might happen and how they might react. And then we talk through that. But unfortunately...
But that doesn't encourage the team. That's just the
anesthetist
working
in
the
silo. That's
exactly
it. In fact, what's interesting is that the human factors theory and practice has been mostly in healthcare limited to the anesthesia space. There's been very little carryover into the other aspects of healthcare, which I think is one of our biggest challenges.
Okay, Richard, ping, 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 ping. How long does this go on for, the ping, ping, pinging?
Intensely for the first few minutes, 3, 4, 5 minutes, but they were going. It was going on generally throughout the whole flight and even on the ground. And the first thing to go when you get busy or distracted or you're losing situation awareness is your hearing. So if you have the alarms going off, it'll certainly make you deaf. And people actually crash airplanes with alarms going off saying the gear's not down.
Because
so
they're not hearing.
There is a massive problem in the man-machine interface and how you tell them something's wrong, but then leave them alone to fix it.
We've had that same problem in healthcare where companies have come out with what they call fail-safe alarms, where even when the alarm issue is addressed, you cannot turn off the alarm unless somebody resets it in a different physical space.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you'll have to put the alarm in a closet, put a blanket over it, just to get it to stop, because you don't have the permission to turn the alarm off. So this is the exact same scenario.
It's exactly
so the companies, for legal reasons, have been taught, we're going to make sure nobody can turn off the alarm unless they're certified or qualified by the company.
You're listening to The Health Report here on Radio National, ABC News and CBC Radio across Canada. And I'm talking to Richard de Crespigny, an A380 senior captain and a senior pilot on QF-32, which, as you've heard, had a disastrous explosion several years ago. And Paul Barish, who's a human factors researcher on safety and quality in healthcare, also an anaesthetist. So you've got 5 senior pilots sitting there. Were they allocated tasks, or was it just you and the co-pilot?
The 3 pilots flying, myself, Matt Hicks, the first officer, and Mark Johnson, the second officer. The 2 other check captains, when the engine exploded, they ceased to check me and they came in to start assisting me.
From my memory of the story is that you ended up ignoring the alarms because you didn't know what was wrong with the, still didn't know what was wrong with the plane, and you stripped the plane back to almost like a Cessna.
The fuel system, half the pumps on the left-hand wing broke. Both the transfer ducts were broken. There was about 15 holes in the fuel tanks. The jettison valve was broken. Then both fuel control computers failed. When we reset the computers, the screens came up with a whole lot of crosses. And I said to the whole crew out loud, something which is not good to say during a route check, I said, I'm looking at this fuel system and I don't understand it. Does anybody understand this fuel system? And everyone was silent. So at that point of maximum confusion, I lost it. All the training I had to assimilate all these, I lost the plot. My mental model of the airplane now failed. I just didn't understand what was working and wasn't working. Now, if you don't have fuel, you don't have engines. And so I wasn't sure if we were about to lose all the engines. So at that point of maximum confusion and a loss of what to do, my body flicked in 2 ways. I went to climb to do what we call an Armstrong spiral, which is a glide descent back to Singapore. And the second thing I did was I inverted the logic. Now, these aircraft have 4 million parts, complex systems, driving complex systems. Working with a complex system from the top down doesn't work because you don't understand it and you never will. Reverse the logic, work from the bottom up. So I was trying to build a Cessna. It was like, do I have enough wheels to hold the airplane? Yes. Do I have lift? Yes. Do I have enough thrust? Do I have enough fuel? So we're taking a complex aircraft and reducing it down to a flying lawnmower. And when we did that, we had a base, simple machine that would fly and the stress levels came down.
So let's go to everything goes pear-shaped in a healthcare situation. I mean, often they go pear-shaped slowly rather than quickly like this. You know, the question of recognizing it. This notion of losing it, is that common in healthcare?
In the operating theater, we talk about the sudden silence. If it suddenly gets really quiet, you know something really bad is happening. That usually tends to mean a surgeon who is suddenly encountering something they don't know, the moment you're describing. And for anesthesia, that means you got to double down and be ready for what might come down the pike. And so then we have a whole series of actions that we've improvised.
Rather than trained for.
Exactly. So for example, when I teach my anesthetists, my registrars, I teach them that the operating room has three spheres, on the table, at the table, and below the table. So I teach them actually to bend down to the floor and see what's going on below. So if there's a pool of blood on the floor, you know you're in serious trouble, even before the surgeon says, oh, we have a problem here. But more importantly, as a team, the lack of information means other team members are unable to engage to their full capacity. And so the ability to recognize a problem and call it. So we've now taught them in the simulator, we have a problem. So we identify this is the problem. And that helps to kind of realign people. And they go, okay, this is what we need to do. Very similar to what you did, Richard.
So Richard, it sounds to me as if you were improvising rather than falling back on your training.
Yes. This reversing of the logic is not something that is taught.
Was anybody challenging you in the cockpit?
No. Oh, they did challenge me when I wanted to climb, but the climb, which I call an Armstrong spiral, is something that I researched and sent to Airbus for a suggestion for their flight control systems for the A350. So I was all tuned up with that. But when I went to climb to do this on the day, no other pilots knew about this, and I hadn't explained it. So I was taking them on to a place that they had never been before, and they didn't like it. So they said, stop. All other four pilots said, stop. I knew what I wanted to do. I had a good reason for doing it because I wanted to guarantee we could glide. No one understood it. So how do I face this?
So here's your promise on the bus. Tell me when I'm doing something wrong. Now they're telling you and you're going to ignore them.
So this is a good challenge. And I thought, whoa, settle back. Maybe I'm so stressed out, I can't see a solution and they can. Let's go for another minute and we'll see. So I stopped the climb. I listened to them and I stopped it. They didn't call that stop out of ego. They called that stop because they thought I was going to do harm.
Yep.
I'm glad they called stop. It doesn't matter whether they were right or wrong. It was my fault that I hadn't explained what this spiral was. But in 30 seconds time, if I really thought I had to do it, it could be the captain's call and I could climb. But in 30 seconds after I had also inverted the logic, a sense of calm and control came back and I didn't need to climb. They thought I was going to go to full power and destroy the other engines.
You encouraged them to tell you the truth.
I had the ability to override them, but I better have a good reason. And this is not based on ego. I have a good system saying, well, this is why we must do it and I'm going to do it.
Were you ever trained to actually do that non-technical stuff or was it you?
Pilots are trained to raise concerns when something's wrong.
Yeah, but that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about your response here as the person in charge.
I believe there is no case where the individual will beat a team. In a technical sphere, the team will always beat the individual.
This is a big differential between healthcare and aviation. This assumed power equivalency and the norms. You're talking about understood norms over time where it's expected that you would get that type of truth-telling and feedback and you, in return, would respect that. You might not always accept it, but you'd respect the input.
In my next book, I'm describing the test called Man on the Moon, and the man, he crashes.
So just to explain here, you've got a book called Fly coming out, and it's about personal resilience.
Personal corporate resilience. In the teamwork chapter, I discuss this mission on the moon where you crash and you have to go 60 kilometers and you have to pick the tools and implements that you'll take. And in every case, the team will do a better result than the individual.
Shakespeare's book, Greatest Works.
Absolutely.
But I would argue before the team comes the culture. If you have a culture that doesn't enable the types of team behaviors, it's going to be very difficult to get truth-telling. So in healthcare, we have a challenge. Again and again, clinicians say that fear drives their behavior, their inability to speak up when they see a problem. If your culture doesn't enable psychological safety, instead you feel psychological danger. So if you speak up, you might be marginalized or demoted or unable to execute your professional abilities. You're not going to necessarily speak up even when you think there's a problem.
I agree. And you have to enable people to speak up. If the person says you haven't washed your hands, you have to stop and do it. If you have a checklist that says wash your hands is number one, you just can't gloss over that. You will not proceed with that checklist until everyone's washed their hands. I say to pilots before my flight, I will make mistakes and I need you to highlight them. You can be as pedantic as you want. Just prioritize when to tell me. And I have two debriefs, one as we finish the climb before we start cruising. And so we discuss the takeoff and the departure and I'll do another one after we land. Now, at the whole time, I start with my errors to show vulnerability and humility. And then with that, the other pilots and say, well, look, don't be hard on yourself. I made this mistake. And before you know it, everyone volunteers their mistakes. And you're making a list of these and you learn from them. Truth, it's a serious exercise.
So the more people tell the truth, the more when you open it up.
So how do you get
way,
that culture into medicine?
Well, this is a big challenge. First of all, governance is really important. Who actually adds the most value to the product? Is it the executive suite or is it the people on the front line? In healthcare, the nurses, pharmacists, and physicians are the ones that deliver value to the system. That means that the governance of those people must be such that we allow them to make sense of the process. So when rules and regulations are come down, they only really work if the people at the front line understand why you're doing them, number one. Number two, that there's a just and transparency about if it doesn't happen. And finally, that they're able to say, I disagree, or let's do it this way, or let's change it. And a lot of times, governance doesn't respect that. And so what happens is that the clinicians on the front line...
They're told what to do.
Yes. And so they either dismiss it but or that, they work
so,
around it.
So that's top-down. And yes. In a sense, in a major airline, you have top-down too. They have rules and protocols.
Yes, yes.
You have the book. You've got to follow it. But that sort of horizontal teamwork that Richard's talking about, which is, I'm here to be challenged, and it's a two-way street.
Hmm.
And that's a safe conversation... For the benefit of the patient, how do you get that culture?
I think you have to go back to fundamentals. And that means that you have to understand the real work versus the imagined work. So the real work of a complex pediatric team doing heart surgery in Westmead Hospital or a real obstetric case, that means better understanding of the complex non-recorded events that happen between team members. The subtle signs and symptoms of trust and truth-telling and transparency, that's how meaningful teamwork has evolved in aviation, where pilots could say, this isn't working, and then there'd be a process that would pay attention to those signals. Inevitably, around the world, what's emerging is that, particularly physicians, but not only, there's a growing epidemic of unhappiness, of depression, of burnout. And the number one reasons of these drivers are lack of top-down systems, the micromanagement, the clunky technologies and information systems, and the inability of clinicians to understand how the system works to deliver better safety and better quality.
But I always say that there's only a limit to how much you can compare aviation to healthcare, because the pilot goes down with the plane, the doctor never goes down with the patient. I mean, isn't that...
And that's a cheap shot. And so
I think
my answer to that
too.
Is...
I'm a journalist. What do you
that
want
means,
to?
Well, that means that patient safety would improve if the doctor died with the patient.
But you cannot divorce yourself from this. You're all on the same metal tube.
Paul had a good statement about a team and who's the most important team member.
It's the patient. It's not the anesthetist. It's not the nurse. It's not the executive. So this is a very, very important principle. We must design safety and healthcare systems with the patient as part of that equation.
Even though they're unconscious under the blanket.
So 2 years ago, I was diagnosed with colon cancer and had a massive surgery, chemotherapy, et cetera. And my wife, who was a professor of surgery, and I struggled to get the team to understand that we were actively part of the team. And they said, we got it. We'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. They weren't interested in our input. And what they were implying was, you're the recipient of our care. How do we rephrase and reframe the idea that the patient and family are truly accountable and responsible for being part of those design questions? In Canada and Sweden now, this is actively being supported by inviting patients to take more responsibility for their care. In Denmark, half of dialysis care is run by patients alone in the hospital overnight and weekend.
Because I was going to ask you that. We tend to focus a lot on surgery because yeah. like a flight, it's episodic.
Yes.
When most people's experience of care, particularly as you get older, is you've got multiple diagnoses, yep. you've got chronic illness, and you've got multiple teams looking after you,
yeah.
which is probably far more important, in fact, than what happens in surgery.
Absolutely. So 95% of care is not delivered in hospitals. And we have an imbalance of focus and money related to that. As patients get older, the silver tsunami, we need patients and families to be more aware, more alert, more engaged, more activated. And that means inviting them through electronic medical records, through patient-centered records, and all the other stuff around that to take more responsibility.
I've got a friend who's a CEO, well, he was a CEO of one of Victoria's largest hospitals. And when he first got there, he walked around and asked people, who are you responsible to and who are you accountable to? Half the clinicians couldn't answer that question. So if you don't know who you're responsible to, how do you decide your priorities? Will someone be able to override you on a patient safety issue that may cost lives?
So you land.
Yes. We all survived. It was 2 hours in the air, 2 hours on the ground with another high-risk situation where it was outside the square. We couldn't shut an engine down. There was fuel pouring on the ground. There was half the pilots would probably say we should have evacuated.
So it didn't end when you landed.
Oh, no, it went for another 2 hours on the ground in a high-risk situation on the ground with the potential for fire. Well, that most difficult decision that went over 2 hours was whether we evacuate down the slides. If we'd evacuated down the slides on that 380 and onto the Singapore tarmac, I think some people wouldn't be here today. We had to decide, are you safer inside or outside?
Now, we last spoke on Late Night Live a few years ago. What's happened since, Paul?
Healthcare has been spending a lot of time, money, and political capital on making healthcare safer. And what's been remarkable is the number of rules has skyrocketed, the number of requirements for training, assessment, more and more accreditation around the world. Unfortunately, what's emerged is despite all that great work, when you look at studies, both in Australia and overseas, the improvement in quality has been slow. Which begs a very difficult question. How is it that we're adopting more and more rules, more regulations, more structures, but we're not getting the safety and value benefit? And perhaps the answer is not more rules. The answer is to go back to the fundamentals of complex system safety. And that is that unless the people on the front end of care, the nurses, pharmacists, technicians, et cetera, unless they understand in a deep way the center of the system, the complexity of the process, unless they're able to tell the truth and be supported, unless they're able to actually be engaged in the process of innovation and change, it's very difficult to actually get more than marginal improvements.
So Richard, you've just written a book on resilience, corporate and personal. How does this apply to what we're talking about?
I think what aviation has that medicine doesn't is the governance from the highest levels. We need the culture from the top to give psychological safety for the people who are coming in with all these great new skill sets. Resilience is in teams. If you're an autocratic leader, narcissist, you will not be successful.
The other factor is there is radical transparency. The ability to use this information, if we're doing better or worse, in a way that drives improvement. Healthcare has been known to have quite a bit of secrecy, where key bits of information are not available to the public, are not available to the patient, are not available to the clinicians. That situation means that all that information is not available to make better decisions at the point of care.
And what about personal resilience?
Personal resilience means failing well. You can only succeed through failing and learning from your mistakes.
People fear failing in healthcare. It's your ego, but it also you're saying it's patient safety.
Absolutely.
You've got to fail safely.
This is a serious problem because the personal resilience means we have to acknowledge that being under the microscope, being in systems where they can't speak up, has a huge emotional toll. We also like to talk about the second victim. When patients are harmed because of system failures, clinicians tend to feel that they're responsible for the outcome and they emotionally feel terrible about it. We know that leads them to substance abuse. It leads them to crashing their cars. So there's a growing phenomenon now about the indirect harm caused by poor system design that leads to patient harm and the toll it takes on nurses and physicians and technicians.
But our aim is to fail in the little things and learn from them so we get the big things right. And you need to keep that perspective.
You are listening there to Senior Captain Richard Krepney and Safety and Quality Researcher Paul Barish. This has been a special broadcast from the Health Report here on RN. I'm Norman Swan. Hope you join me next week.